All right, Acts chapter 14. Okay, so in Acts chapter 14, we've been going back and forth through the chapter because it lends itself to more of a topical discussion than it does a verse by verse, because we jump around to various places in this chapter. For example, in this particular chapter, what cities are we visiting?
You're going to be Iconium, Lystra, Derbe.
I think that's going to be it. Yeah, because at the end of chapter 13 is when they go from Antioch of Pisidia to Iconium. And then they go to Iconium, Lystra, and Derbe. And then once they're finished at Derbe, then what happens there? All right, to turn around and go back. Given that they're on a journey here, number one, who do we know that's on this journey?
Barnabas
is there. Who else?
Paul.
Yes, there's a kind of a main character there. We don't know for sure of anybody else. Obviously, Luke wrote the book of Acts, and in several instances, we can show by the use of pronouns when he is with the party that's going on the journey. But as near as I can tell, this appears to be just Luke telling the story as revealed to him by the Holy Spirit, as opposed to him being along on this. And we have talked in the past about the fact that this is not a particularly nice country in this area, that there are in the mountainous passes and things like that, there's a lot of robbers and such alike. And we had hypothesized that perhaps it was more than just Paul and Barnabas traveling through here. But we do see that as we go through the portions of the text that we're looking at right now, sort of down towards 6+, as far as the location goes, that it does just mention Paul and Barnabas. So it's entirely possible that they were by themselves, though a large company would be better. Okay, we had spoken previously about this, the idea of speaking boldly in the Lord. We talked about the purposes of gospel preaching, that it produces faith that leads to salvation, that the purpose of it is to oppose faithlessness. And so we can see that later on in this chapter about verse 13, when they were about to attempt to offer offerings to them as gods. And Paul referred to those as vain things. And it's for the purpose of strengthening the souls of the disciples. When do we see that that particularly was discussed? We haven't gotten to that yet, but right, as they come back. And then they use the teaching opportunities that God gives to speak boldly. And we talked last time about a door being opened to them in verse 27. And we see that we talked about 1 Corinthians 16 and 2 Corinthians 2 that also talk about a door being open to them. And, of course, we see the door being open to Paul on the second journey when he was up in Ephesus. I think it was the second journey. We spoke a bit about the city that they went to, Iconium, being about 120 miles northeast of the Mediterranean. And according to the American Tract Society Dictionary, as I mentioned, published in 1859, they got there in 45 A.D. Not sure how they come up with that date. I noticed that in 1859 and in times around that they made up a lot of facts, as it were. And I think we talked also about Lycaonia, and that is a district in Asia Minor. It's not a city. It's just an area. And it's more of a Quartz Hill-like thing. It's not an incorporated something. It's not an official boundary. It's just an area where people are. I like the description from Smith's Bible Dictionary from 1863 that talks about, for the most part, a dreary plain, bare of trees, destitute of fresh water, and with several salt lakes. So, as I mentioned last week, that reminds us of some area around here, doesn't it? Yeah. Major cities, of course, Lystra and Derbe. And though it talks about the speech of Lyconia, we have no idea really what that is. There's a bunch of hypotheses as to what it might be, but no real examples of Lyconian dialect being left around today. All right, so we've gotten then to the city of Lystra. We started to discuss that last time because that's where they had gone. So they had been forced out of Antioch of Pisidia. They went down to Iconium, and they decided it was the better part of valor then for them to head out of there also when
verse 15?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought, wow, I don't see that many verses.
I was in chapter 30.
Oh, okay, yeah. So as far as Lystra goes, in verse 16, it talks about the Jews came thither from Antioch and Iconium. So the Jews didn't come from any small distance away. Now, obviously, Iconium is not that far away. But if they came from Antioch, that's a fur piece, as they say. So we're down now in Lystra. This was what the Romans called a colonia, which I guess to us would be a colony. But it was an official sort of Roman settlement. It was about 18 miles south of Iconium. It's in the same sort of plain that the city of Iconium is. It has this guy in Easton's Bible Dictionary from 1893 says it's in a wild district among a rude population. So, of course, English language is a little different back in 1893. Rude may just mean untaught, something like that. But or they could have been rude, for all I know. But we realize that there were, as we look at the things that went on in Lystra, we realize that there were going to sacrifice to Paul and Barnabas, being Jupiter and Mercury, because they were idolatrous people, and they thought because of the miracle that was performed there in Lystra, that these were gods come down from essentially from Mount Olympus type thing. So if you look up the history around Lystra, it does appear that there was a temple to Zeus that was located at or nearby the city, and that there was a statue of Hermes in the vicinity. So International Standard Bible Encyclopedia points that out. Maybe in 1915 they decided to use a few more facts than from 1859, but so I think that area was used to worshiping Zeus and Hermes, and these two that had come among them and had shown this miracle. Now, what miracle did they show here in the town of Lystra? They healed a lame man. He'd been lame for just like a couple of months, right? Yeah, from birth. Yeah, so we don't know how old he was. It doesn't say how old he was, but it mentions that he's a man and that he's been lame from birth. And as with many miracles regarding lame people, or I should say with all miracles regarding lame people, what did he do when Paul said, "Get up and walk"? He leaped up and walked. That's an interesting thing to look at, because it does say that he leaped. And I think we've mentioned this time after time, that if we break an arm or break a leg and we've got it in a cast for 6-8 weeks, something like that, when the cast comes off, we just go running around on our leg right away, right? No, we have to strengthen it up. This man had never walked. When you look at the little ones, when they're born, it takes them a long time to learn how to walk, how to get their balance and all that sort of stuff. This man never had to do that because he was lame from birth. He never could walk. Or, well, it says he was infirm, right? It doesn't necessarily say lame, but
it says never walked.
Yeah, okay, yeah, it does say. That's right. Right. Oh, does it? Which verse is that?
Verse 8, the blessed of the man was sitting with no strength in his feet, lame from his mother's womb, would never walk.
Mine says a cripple.
Oh, this one said, yeah, the American Standard says a cripple. So, yeah, that, I guess we can presume that lame is a good term to use. So he just got up and leaped and walked. Now, who else do we see earlier on in the book of Acts? It did the same thing. Right, in the third chapter. And in the third chapter is the what gospel sermon? Second gospel sermon. All right. So we see exactly almost the same thing happen to the man in the third chapter of the book of Acts. This man had been lame for what? That one, they said 38 years, right, I think, is the one. And this man had been lame all his life. And they just leaped up and started walking. It's amazing. No 6-month-old is going to do that. He has to learn. Yeah. Some of us learn to walk and kept right on walking, and then others have a difficult time getting around now. So, but this man leaped up and walked. It's just amazing. So, but anyway, when that occurred, then of course they wanted to sacrifice to them because Barnabas was obviously Zeus and Paul was obviously Hermes. Why was Paul called Hermes or Mercury? The noisy one. He's the one that had his mouth open all the time, right? So, who was Mercury? Mercury was the messenger. Yep. So, Mercury, the messenger of the gods, and so that's why they called Paul Hermes. And as I've said before, just speculation on my part, they called Barnabas Zeus, because perhaps he was older than Paul. Who knows? Mickey.
One of the things we've been emphasizing in the study of Acts is the effects of preaching and the means that they utilized to be in. And you commented earlier from verse 3 that they're there in a convent for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And they spoke boldly. And then we noted in verse 7 that they came to other areas. They preached the gospel. I found that interesting in connection with this lame man who has never walked, that in verse 9 it says, the same heard Paul speaking. Well, what's Paul been speaking? He's been preaching.
Yes, he has.
And it's been noteworthy to this man that's been lame all of his life. And I think that sets the stage for many of the things that we read.
Yeah, and I think the phrase that says that seeing that he had the faith to be made whole doesn't just pop out of here from nowhere. As Mickey says, he's been listening to Paul preach the gospel. And I think that we can say in connection with that, he began to have the faith that he needed to be a Christian. We don't see if anything came of that, but we see that there was some apparent belief on his part to the gospel that was being preached. Randy?
Verse 9, this man was listening to Paul as he spoke, who, when he fixed his gaze on him, and had seen that he had faith to be made well. There's a marginal reference in my Bible that says, made well literally means saved.
Saved?
Saved.
Oh, okay.
But he had faith to be saved.
Okay.
Which makes more sense.
It certainly does. We could.
It takes faith to be saved. It doesn't take faith to be made well.
Right.
I mean, you know, the man at the pool in John 5 that we talked about Wednesday night.
Yeah. That's verse 9.
He was made well. Yeah, verse 9. But ultimately, that's what they were doing. They were preaching to save souls.
Yeah. I don't know the Greek word. I'd have to look it up and see what it says. Sosthenai. Did you have another comment, Mickey?
I did. One thing in particular is that this man not only heard Paul speaking, but by way of contrast to those others in Lystra who are affirming the gods came down to us like men, I think it could be correct to assume that this man also is a Greek. Just the background that he's been exposed to, the foolishness that we see associated with idolatry, which helps us, at least from my perspective, to see that the things that Paul is presenting, they're perceived by this man as reasonable, logical. They're not foolishness. They're considered as evidence. And he's persuaded.
He is. He does appear to be persuaded. That's right. And so, seeing that he had the faith to be made whole or to be saved, which it would be interesting to do a study on that to see just how that works out. But be that as it may, we don't have any other indication of this man further on down. So hopefully he became one of the disciples that we see mentioned here later on in this particular chapter. All right, so that's where we were at Lystra. We're not going to go on to Derbe yet, though. It's kind of hard to differentiate between where we are and when we're going to get to Derbe regarding the outline that Joe has together here. But let's go on to, unless anyone has some further comments about the city of Lystra itself or the area in which they are, let's go on to talking about speaking boldly in the Lord. And we have a series of slides here called speaking about persuasive gospel preaching. Yes, Jenny?
I went to the interlinear Bible to find out what it meant when it said to be made well, to be saved. There are 10 occurrences in the New Testament, and in every other occurrence, it's be saved. Acts 14:9 is the only one that says to be made well.
Oh, really?
All the other ones are who can be saved, who can be saved, by which we must be saved. You cannot be saved, but we believe that we are saved through Christ. You yourself cannot be saved of the truth so as to be saved, and all men to be saved.
Okay, yeah, because the Greek says exe pistin tu sosthenai, and so that means had the faith toward or to that's being used here, the sosthenai. So it says in every other instance this word is saved then, right? Okay. All right. Well, that certainly adds a flavor, we should say, to the text that we have here that talks about the fact that when it says that this man had faith to be made whole or to be saved, indeed, we see that there, in many instances, there was a reason why the translators translated it that way. And at least with the King James Version, we know that it was to keep certain practices of the Church of England intact. And so when Passover, the word that's the Greek word for Passover, I forget what it is. Every other time that it's used, it's called Passover, but in one instance in the King James Version, it's called Easter. And that was done so that the Church of England could make sure that the holiday of Easter was kept in the gospel. But it should say Passover. All right. So that would be an interesting thing to look into and make sure that we have a good understanding of that verse right there. But it's a good point that you say it was used 9 times in the New Testament?
9 additional times.
Okay. Randy?
Acts 12:4 was the passage we were looking for.
Acts 12:4. What passage was I looking for?
Where it says Passover. King James says.
Oh, that's right. Acts. What was it? 12:4?
Acts 12:4.
Right. It says Easter in the King James. In every other version, it says Passover. And in every other instance of the word, that Greek word, it's used as Passover. Okay, so as we go into the things, and I think the reason that Joe Price in his outline here has essentially, I don't want to say ignored the things that were going on in a temporal nature, but emphasized the spiritual, is that there's so much in this chapter that's about, here's what the gospel is about. As we've mentioned before, in the first 3 verses of this, there's so much meat in there, you could spend, as we have, several weeks just talking about the first 3 verses. As we look at this, we can understand that it mentions in a couple of instances in here that people were persuaded by the word that was spoken, that multitudes came to the faith. We can see that in Iconium. We can see that in Lystra. And later on, we'll see that in Derbe, that people were persuaded by the gospel that was preached. And so it seems reasonable to look at how persuasive gospel preaching is built. And, of course, careful reasoning from the scriptures, as is said in verse 1, doesn't say those words, but verse 1, it says in the American Standard, they so spake that a great multitude both of Jews and Greeks believed. So the reasoning that they were going through here was something that was logical to the people that were listening to them, that was important, and that showed them or pointed them to the truth, which they then believed. And we can go on further on down and see that they continued to preach the gospel. There was at Lystra, and so they preached at Lystra also, and then later on we'll see that they preached at Derbe. Well, if we go back a chapter to chapter 13 and look at the long dissertation that Paul had in the synagogue in Antioch of Pisidia, he said, men of Israel and you that fear God, hearken. And then he went on and went through a listing, a reasoning of what was going on in the scriptures and how it led to Jesus Christ. It is interesting to note that this is not something new. We can look at almost every chapter in the book of Acts up till now and see the same sort of careful reasoning going forward. If you look at Acts, the second chapter, in verses 14 through 36, as Peter is bringing the first gospel sermon, you might say, there is careful reasoning through there with the audience that he has in front of him to let them know what it is they need to know based on their knowledge at that time. If we go to Acts, the third chapter, as we've just spoken about the lame man there being healed, Peter again, in verses 12 through 26, talks to the people that are there and reasons with them carefully about what is going on in the scriptures and how it points to Jesus Christ, and how that it was not they themselves, Peter and James, was it James, that was there at the temple. It wasn't from their power that they raised this man, but it was through Jesus Christ. And then he talked to them about him. Also in Acts, the seventh chapter, in verses 1 through 53, when we talk about Stephen. Stephen went through a long dissertation there of who Jesus Christ was based on the history of the people to whom he was speaking. Also in Acts, the eighth chapter, in verse 35, we see that Philip the evangelist, when talking to the Ethiopian eunuch, persuaded him also through his speaking of the gospel. And then also in Acts, the 11th chapter, in verses 4 through 17, when Peter is making his defense before the brethren at Jerusalem, we see that he also goes through careful reasoning as to how he did these. And it says that he spoke to them in order the things that had gone on with the household of Cornelius. And so it's not a foreign thing for careful reasoning from the scriptures to come about during the preaching of the gospel. We can see that from Acts chapter 1 all the way up to where we are now, that it was careful reasoning from the scriptures that led people to believe. Mickey?
You can't lead people to believe without.
Right.
It has to be careful reasoning from the scriptures, but we can't do that if we don't know what the scriptures say.
Right. We have to know what the scriptures are in order to reason carefully. That's important for us to know. And I'm trying to remember, was 2 Timothy, is it, that talks about I'm not even going to come up with any of the words now. Let me look at it real quick. 2:15, yeah. I could think of the citation, but not the words. Yeah, give diligence to present thyself approved unto God, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed, handling aright the word of truth. Or, as the King James Version says, study to show yourself approved unto God. And so these are things that we need to know in order to do this carefully. We can't reason carefully if we don't know what the pathway that we need to go down is. So that's why we have to be not just students of the Word, but scholars of the Word. We need to know what the Word is, forwards and backwards, you might say. Notice that when they were later on, in the next preaching tour in Thessalonica, in Acts the 17th chapter, in verses 2 and 3, Acts 17, verses 2 and 3. If someone gets there before me, you can read it.
And Paul, as his custom was, went into them, and for 3 Sabbaths reasoned with them from the Scriptures, explaining and demonstrating that the Christ had suffered and rise again from the dead, saying, "This Jesus whom I preach to you is the Christ."
All right. So it says he reasoned with them, and he opened, and what does the verse say? Explain to them? Okay, we've got... explaining and demonstrating. Okay. And we see then that the explaining and the reasoning goes hand in hand with the preaching of the gospel. It has to. And so he definitely reasoned with them there in Thessalonica. Also, Bruce, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, King James says he reasoned with them out of the Scriptures and opened and alleged that Christ had the Scriptures. So he reasoned and opened and alleged.
Right. I think it's interesting to note that it says that he opened. It doesn't say he opened the Scriptures, but it says reason with them from the Scriptures, opening and alleging. So I think that we can say that they opened it up. In other words, the books that were before them, whatever they had, scrolls or books or whatever they were using at that time, he used those Scriptures themselves to reason with them and to show them how Jesus was the one that was being prophesied about. What? Did I make a misspeak?
No. And in verse 4, you see the results of that persuasion is that the people were persuaded.
Yes, right. The people were persuaded in verse 4 of Acts 17.
I appreciate that it didn't say they had this natural feeling. They were persuaded. They understood and they believed it. And it was something not just that happened to them.
Right. Yeah, this was not something, what is it? Better felt than told or something like that. But the persuasion was there. These people were persuaded into things that they had been told. Yeah.
One of the things that you're emphasizing, I think, correctly so, is that this was the result of preaching the gospel, presenting the evidence. You can't convert or persuade people without that. We're not talking about the direct operation of the Holy Spirit. We're not talking about pizza and volleyball. We're talking about teaching people the Scriptures.
Yes.
You can't convert people without it.
That's right. In order to be the person that God speaks about in His book, then you have to hear His words. And that's the important thing. Alright, and this goes along with that, talking about speaking truth and reason. In Paul's defense before Festus, if you look at Acts the 26th chapter and verses 24 and 25, anybody gets there? Acts 26, 24? Acts 26, 24 and 25, it says, and this is talking about Paul, and as he thus made his defense, Festus said with a loud voice, "Paul, thou art mad. Thy much learning is turning thee mad." But Paul saith, "I am not mad, most excellent Festus, but speaketh forth words of truth and soberness." So Paul spoke words of truth and soberness. I think one of the versions says truth and reason, right? Randy, is that what it says?
New American Standard says, "I utter words of sober truth."
Sober truth, okay.
And there's a marginal reference that says literally of truth and rationality.
Of truth and rationality, okay. Rationality. Is that a 5-syllable word? But Jenny, what does the English Standard say?
ESV says, well, Paul said, I am not out of my mind, most excellent Festus, but I am speaking true and rational words.
True and rational words. Rationality, for sure. The truth and reason is evident to the people when they hear the gospel being preached. Because as they go through this and do this careful reasoning, then things just start lining up. Mickey, you've seen that in your discussions with people, where all of a sudden it's like a light bulb moment, as you say. Just you start leading them and start just taking the steps and checking off the steps and say, "Oh, is that what it is?" Back where we're from in New Mexico, the story had been told about one of the men that later on became an elder in the congregation there, Ken White, that he had been raised in the Catholic Church. And he started coming there, I think, because his wife was a Christian. And he was listening to lessons. And finally, after listening to lessons for like a year, he just stood up one day in the middle of the sermon and said, "Are you telling me that I'm not saved?" And he said, the preacher said, "Yes." And then went through the things. And Ken finally realized what was being said. That the steps that had been outlined up until this time made him think about that. And made him come to the realization that, wait a minute, this is different than what I've been taught. But this is right out of the book. And so when it's right out of the book, you have no other conclusion to come to, but what must I do to be saved? And so he's lived an exemplary life since then as a member of the Lord's church. In the defense before Festus, then, talking about speaking truth and reason, and then, of course, we've had the three articles in the iPress bulletin about Paul reasoning with the Roman authorities, and how was it? It was Felix, wasn't it? Was being afraid of the things that were being said because of the reasoning that Paul was having with him. And then the result then of this reasoning is that people have faith in the power of God. As opposed to that of men. We see that demonstrated a little bit in this attempted sacrifice that they tried to make there at Lystra, and how Paul called it one of these vain things. And we see that these are things that are set up by man, not by God. But if we look at 1 Corinthians 2nd chapter 1 through 5, anybody get there yet? 1 Corinthians 2, 1 through 5.
"And I, when I came to you, brothers, did not come proclaiming to you the testimony of God with lofty speech or wisdom, for I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. And I was with you in weakness and in fear and much trembling, and my speech and my message were not in plausible words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, so that your faith might not rest in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God."
All right. So I think we see here an implication also in 1 Corinthians, the second chapter, when it talks about not in persuasive words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, that indeed Paul was alluding to miracles that were performed at that time that they saw. But also, I think we understand that it has to do also with the wisdom of God. So when he talks about not with excellency of speech or wisdom, and verse 1, that he brought the testimony of God, that's the important thing that they saw, is the testimony of God. Now, as we will get to on the next slide, we talk about the miraculous validation of the gospel preaching. I think we can see an implication of that here when it talks about the fact that in demonstration of the Spirit and of power. We do, however, remember seeing that when Barnabas was sent up to Antioch of Syria, he saw the grace of God in them. And so he saw the things that were being done by them, the things, the belief that they had. And so it was to a certain extent a tangible thing that they could see. And so we can see this, the demonstration of the Spirit and of power also, not just through the miracles that were performed at that place, but the things that the people do and the way that they act. And we see that as we go through the gospel that's being explained here in chapter 14, that people were going out and proclaiming this gospel to other people also. So that's much of the Spirit and of power also. But we certainly, obviously, don't disclaim the fact that miraculous validation was part of the things that were going on here. We saw that occurred here in Lystra with the healing of the lame man, and I believe we saw it in as we go back just earlier in the chapter, that it just mentions that in Antioch that was true also. Where was it? In verse 3, granting signs and wonders to be done by their hands. So signs and wonders were done by them, and this was one of the persuasive tools that was used in preaching the gospel. It's not the only one. A lot of people would have us to think that the only way that people can be persuaded of the gospel is to see a miracle, and that this was not the only way that they did. This was one of the techniques or items that they used. Randy?
I see a parallel with what's spoken by Peter in Acts 2.
Acts 2?
Mm-hmm. Acts 2:22. He's talking about Jesus, and he says, "Men of Israel, listen to these words. Jesus the Nazarene, a man attested to you by God with miracles and wonders and signs, which God performed through him in your midst. Just as you yourselves know, this man delivered over by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, you nailed to a cross by the hands of godless men and put him to death." So, in spite of all the miracles he did, if they don't want to believe, they don't want to believe.
Right.
And they're not going to believe the miracles or the words that he's speaking. And then you carry that over here and look at verse 2 of chapter 14. The Jews who disbelieved stirred up the minds of the Gentiles and vented them against the brethren. They weren't going to believe the words, and they weren't going to believe the miracles.
Right.
And then right after it says that signs and wonders were done by their hands, verse 4, but the people of the city were divided. Divided? How would you be divided if you're watching miracles?
Exactly.
But if you're determined not to believe, then you won't.
Well, we look at our Wednesday class, and we look at the man that was healed that was there by the pool. The Jews were not impressed by the fact that he was healed. What they were impressed with the fact was that it was the Sabbath day and he was carrying his bed around. And it's like, what? Yeah. And we look at the people in the wilderness as they were wandering away from Egypt. And it talks about that they've murmured against God, lo, these 10 times, as Moses says later on. They saw the miracles. They themselves that were wandering around saw these miracles, and yet still, can we say, disbelieve them?
They crossed the Red Sea on dry land.
On dry land, right.
And then they don't think that they can beat the giants again.
That's right. So, and, you know, the Red Sea had been there for who knows how long, and that earth underneath the Red Sea had been there wet for who knows how long. And when God split it back, when they crossed over, it was dry land. That's an important thing to look at in and of itself. Not only did God divide the sea, but when they went over on dry ground. Same thing with the Jordan, when they crossed over into the Promised Land. When God divided the Jordan River, it was dry. They didn't go sloshing through the mud. It wasn't back at the Red Sea. It wasn't until God discomfited them, the Pharaoh's army, and took the wheels off their chariots, that they had any problem. Also, they were going over on dry. They didn't go. It doesn't say anything about them sinking in the mud, I don't think. Yeah, Mickey.
I also wonder 2 or 3 things. Evidence is received by reasonable people. You know, Paul presented evidence. Thessalonica, as you go to Acts 17.
Mm-hmm.
But as you read just a little bit further, well, the evidence, for the most part, some received But for the most part, it's rejected in Thessalonica. But he agreed on them, the Bereans were more noble
yes.
than those in Thessalonica. What did they do? They searched the scriptures. They were reasonable, examined the scriptures to see if what they had been taught was true. Now, regarding this element of miraculous, I've talked with people, and of course you have too, that would say, well, if I saw a miracle, I would believe it. No, if you won't believe the evidence that's presented, neither would you believe if one be raised from the dead, Abraham.
Exactly.
Luke 16. That's the point. To confirm the word through signs and miracles, or signs and wonders, you're dependent on reasonable people to look at the evidence. If we won't look at the evidence, then the performance of the miracle doesn't mean anything. As we see Jews there in Acts 3, 4, 5, the notion of miracle has been performed. We cannot deny it.
No, that's right. We cannot deny it.
But we're not going to believe it.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So it's almost beyond belief to think that people can say a notable miracle has been performed. We can't deny it and yet not believe it. Wait a minute. And the thing also that we've talked about the disobedient Jews. Where was it? There it is in verse 2. Talked about the disobedient, and the other one was unbelieving.
It says the Jews who disbelieved.
Disbelieved.
It also says or disobeyed.
Or disobeyed. Jenny, what's American Standard, ESV have in 2?
Verse 2 of Acts
14. Yeah. Disobedience stirred up the souls of the Gentiles.
But the unbelieving Jews stirred up the Gentiles and poisoned their minds against the brethren.
Okay, so ESV says unbelieving. Here we have disobedient. And I think we pointed this out before, that if they were unbelieving and disobedient, what were they unbelieving and disobedient about? Not only the gospel, but what had Paul been preaching to them? From the scriptures. They had to disbelieve the scriptures that were before them that they'd been believing for millennia. And all of a sudden now, they chose not to believe the scriptures that showed that Jesus was the Messiah. Yes, Mickey.
Well, that same thing was true during the preaching of the law. He said, search the scriptures. They testified in agreement with John 5. But if you reject Moses, then how could it be expected to be doing that elsewhere?
Yeah. And they sought to kill him. And eventually ended up doing that. So, as we look at what gospel preaching is built on, or persuasive gospel preaching is built on, one of the stones, you might say, is the signs and wonders, because that does obviously then validate the words that are being said by the people that are speaking. I had looked up Mark 16:20. Did anybody just go there and stay on that? Mark 16:20. Yeah.
And they went forth and preached everywhere, the Lord working with them and confirming the word with signs following them. Amen.
Okay. So we see that at the end of the book of Mark, when he's sort of signing off this book here, he talks about the fact that that signs followed after these apostles that were preaching. And that then validated the word that they had spoken. It's revelation from God is what these things are that they're speaking. And that's important for us to know. I'm not sure I've got a number of verses down here, but note that in Galatians, the first chapter in verses 11 and 12, Galatians chapter 1, verses 11 and 12, it says, "For I make known unto you, brethren, as touching the gospel which was preached by me, that it is not after men. For neither did I receive it from man, nor was I taught it, but it came to me through revelation of Jesus Christ." That's where the gospel came from. That's where the gospel came from at that time and continued to come from as long as revelation was being put forth. We see that we can see the revelation of God, well, certainly throughout the gospels, throughout the Bible. But let's look quickly over at Luke, the second chapter, and verse 25 following. Luke 2:25. Anybody remember what the context is here? Yeah, Jesus and his parents are at the temple. Jesus is just a little one right now. And in verse 25, we're introduced to a man named Simeon. He's a righteous man looking for the consolation of Israel. It says, as we go through verse 32, it had been revealed unto him by the Holy Spirit that he should not see death before he had seen the Lord's Christ. We see that Simeon, in preparation for the coming of the Messiah, that it had been revealed to him that he wouldn't die until he saw the Lord come. What I want to do next week is to discuss a little bit more about Revelation. I think it's important for us to understand that. And so when we talk about miraculous validation of the gospel, we understand that Revelation is part of that. It's not something necessarily that we see where somebody's being raised from the dead, but it's where the New Testament is being written, you might say. So let's start up with that then next week. All right, thank you.